Today's show is brought to you by KickUp. KickUp helps leaders ask the right questions to get actionable data, visualize information to guide effective next steps, and track teacher growth over time. Learn more at kickup.co. This fall's top conference for educators and leaders is the What Great Educators Do Differently conference. It'll be held October 14th and 15th in beautiful Kansas City, Missouri. See speakers like Jeff Zoell, Ken Williams, and Lavana Roth, all past guests here on the show. Register today at WGEDD.com.
Welcome to the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast, where school leaders go to find inspiration and learn world-class strategies from top influencers in education. Better Leaders, Better Schools was created by Daniel Bauer.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Today's guest is Eric Kershat. You're going to learn about him in a minute, but he's going to teach you how to go farther in your conversations. This guy is the master of the DISC assessment and how you can use those personality assessments to strengthen your staff development and your leadership skills too. He's going to talk about why people do what they do and how to build even greater diversity within your team. Like I said, thanks for listening. Appreciate it. Don't take it for granted. Enjoy the show. Well, Eric Kershat is the founder of Harmony Insights, an HR coaching and consulting business focused on helping companies build and grow teams that value diverse communication, personality, and leadership styles. A seasoned corporate HR professional and dynamic DISC assessment instructor, Eric has partnered internationally with thousands of business leaders to get the most out of themselves and their teams. He facilitates group workshops and one-on-one coaching that are at once both highly interactive and deeply introspective. So, Eric, thank you so much for joining us on the Better Leaders, Better Schools show. We'll edit that part. It's no big deal. And even if we keep it in, you know, I can make fun of myself. It's all good.
Right. No problem, Daniel. Thank you for having me.
No problem. Yeah, that's good stuff. I've never stumbled over my tongue in the beginning like that. But hey, there's a first for everything.
Yeah.
So, Eric, you know, you're not necessarily in education, so let's just hop into your leadership style. How would you describe it, and how did you develop it?
Well, that's a good question. I think, and it's funny because I've been struggling. I've been focused on Harmony Insights since about August, and I was a corporate HR professional for about 16 years before that. And I was struggling with figuring out how to brand myself, and I kept coming back to the word coach. Coach and facilitator, but I think that I learned pretty early on, especially in the HR world, that there was a distinct difference between approaching relationships as a coach versus a disciplinarian, you know, and I think my own wiring, we'll talk a little bit about personality styles maybe a little bit later, but my own wiring is to kind of see things black and white. I'm very rules and regulations and guidelines oriented at times, and I had to fight this natural tendency to act like a disciplinarian, and especially when it came to correcting, you know, performance and behavior along the way. And I kept coming back to the word coach, and that really meant something special to me, you know, that when I was having conversations, especially hard conversations with people, you know, my goal wasn't to discipline them, you know, it was to point out maybe something that had to be corrected, but really jump quickly toward a conversation of that was more inspiring and asking some really fundamental questions about what they found meaningful work to be and what people want out of life and what they want out of themselves. And pretty quickly I learned that I got so much farther in my conversations when my leadership style was one of being a coach instead of being a disciplinarian. And it's funny, actually, along the way, I've had to have some really hard conversations, including firing some people and taking away jobs. And there were more than a few people that shook my hand and thanked me on the way out the door.
Wow.
As opposed to what I expected. And I really do chalk that up to approaching those conversations and just leadership in general as what I imagine at least a coach would.
Yeah, and it seems like the folks probably felt honored, even though you were literally telling them that they're going to have to look for another job starting tomorrow or whatever that was. They felt honored through that process, so they were able to hear what you were saying, you know what I mean? And a lot of times there's parables and those type of things, proverbs that teach us if you don't say things with love, right? That it's just going to fall on deaf ears. And so, go ahead.
I was just going to say, not to interrupt, but I treated people as individuals, as people. You know, every time I sat down with somebody, you know, whether I was leading an individual or as a team, it was a group of people, and these people had families, you know, and they had hopes, and they had mortgages potentially, you know, and they had children, and they had people that they were trying to lead, you know. So first and foremost, I wanted to inspire them by giving them that respect to say, I may be in a position of quote unquote power, but that doesn't mean that I have to throw that out around in a way that allows you or makes you feel like any less of a person. And, you know, actually checking in, we were talking a little bit before we started recording about the fact that my girlfriend is a first grade teacher. You know, right. We would come home at the end of the day. She would talk about her day with her first graders. I would talk about my day with adults. And so often there was such overlap between what we were doing. You know, we're both helping people grow, learn right from wrong, you know, develop self-confidence, and the list goes on and on. And that really helped me keep things in perspective in terms of how I wanted to be seen as a leader.
Yeah, and did any of those overlaps surprise you when you found out, hey, I'm doing a lot that is applicable in that first grade classroom and vice versa?
It did, especially when it came down to behavior, and a lot of what I talk about and deal with has to do with behavior primarily in the workplace. But, you know, in terms of how she was recognizing and rewarding behavior and still does in the classroom, there were a lot of parallels with how I needed to recognize and reward behavior and discourage, you know, behavior that I didn't want to have continue.
Sure.
So her examples may have been unique to her age group and mine to mine, but at the end of the day, there was so much overlap that I think we have pushed and challenged one another along the way to look at things a little bit differently at times, but realize how much commonality there is between what we do.
You know, a few moments ago, you mentioned the concept of meaningful work and how people would define that. I'm interested in how, number one, you would define it, and then number two, do you have any advice for us, the Better Leaders listeners? We're, you know, school leaders, and in my opinion, we have probably the easiest job in terms of getting out of the bed every day. Like, there is instant gratification, satisfaction from working with children, seeing that light bulb go on. I see that as meaningful work, but sometimes that light grows dim.
Mm-hmm.
So besides how you would define meaningful work, how can you reignite, right, what is there in front of people too?
I think those are fantastic questions. And honestly, they're questions that some people never really find answers to. I do a lot of volunteer work, including at a place called the Career Transition Center downtown, where I'm working with adults who are between jobs. And I learned really quickly that there are a lot of people out there who don't believe that they can do work that they're passionate about, that they're meaning, that they would find to be meaningful. A lot of people say, well, you know, I've always been paid for this, but I may have some talent there, or I may have some skill, but I would never in a million years say that this is something that I'm interested in or passionate about. And I find one of my biggest roles that I play is to inspire people to believe that meaningful work is possible. So I'm glad you asked about that. You know, there are different models you can point to. When I'm talking to people about meaningful work, I talk about that model having three legs. You know, one is something that you have demonstrated skill at, you know, that you have some ability. Number two, something that you're passionate about, that your heart is telling you that you want to do just as much as your head might be. And then three, that there's an economic model for it, that there's a market for it. If you only have one or two of those three legs, you might not have work that's viable at the end of the day. Mm. And a lot of people get stuck in the doing something that they're good at. I was in that role for a while myself, where I had to wake up one day and say, for years I've been doing something that is a strength of mine, that I am good at, that I excel at, but my heart wasn't in it in the way that I wanted it to be. And I think that's what catches people up. They don't, number one, consider that that might be an opportunity. And if they do, they're not sure how to go about it. The perfect example is I was sitting with a guy, and this sounds like an entirely made up story, but I was literally sitting on the bank of Lake Geneva in Switzerland. And I had been out there actually to facilitate a workshop for a school, a staff at a school out there.
Okay.
And I'm sitting with a guy who had spent years in insurance, and he wanted a little career coaching. Since I did some of that while I was out there, I agreed to sit with him, and I talk through, you know, what have you done? Well, I've always done insurance. You know, what could you do? Well, I guess, you know, I can only do insurance because that's what I've ever done. So I shifted the conversation. We started talking about what he was passionate about. He started telling me stories about, you know, personal fitness and spending time at the gym and photography. And I asked a simple question about how he could monetize those things. And, you know, he just kind of went blank. He had this stare on his face. And he said, I've never stopped to consider that I could make money doing something that I've always had as a hobby or something that I've had as a extracurricular interest.
Wow.
And that was a light bulb moment for him. And the more we talked about it, the more he realized, you know, that would be meaningful work for me. And so it just came down to putting a plan together that would allow him to transition from what he had been doing for so many years into something that his heart was telling him, you know, he could find more interest in.
Well, I love the way you illustrated that story. And so I'm going to ask you to tell another story. And you founded your company, Harmony Insights. So please tell us a story of how did you start it and why, too?
Sure. And it's actually, it has its roots in some of the things we've already been talking about. You know, I was in corporate HR in the same place for 16 years, fantastic company. And it was getting to the point where I was realizing that I was doing so much that I happened to be good at, a position that had kind of built up around me. And there was one week in particular where I left my desk. I spent a lot of time in Excel, a lot of time with numbers. And I left my desk to teach or facilitate a workshop. And it happened to be a DISC workshop, which is the personality assessment that I work with. And it hit me. And I had an inkling that this was going to be the case, but it was particularly clear that day that that was something that I was really excited about. And unfortunately, it was only one of many responsibilities I had in that HR role. And I thought, I need to do something more with this. I don't know exactly what it's going to look like. I don't know even if I'm wired to be an entrepreneur. But I need to try something a little bit more entrepreneurial. And I had been listening to podcasts for a while. I had been inspired by so many virtual mentors. And I kind of had a sense of what would go into it. I started playing around with some branding, some names. Music has always been important to me. So Harmony was one of the things that rose to the top pretty quickly. And yeah, I happen to be fairly analytical. I really like connecting the dots for people and allowing them to have insights into who they are and what they do, the reason behind their actions and their behaviors and their communication style. And Harmony Insights kind of came to the top. And I thought, that's it. That's what I need to do. And, you know, kind of had it on the back burner for a little bit. But after a couple of years, I made that transition. That was this past August, actually. And it's been rewarding and challenging in all the ways that I had hoped it would be.
let's dial in into that idea of it being on the back burner. Because I think, you know, I'd like to hear why. Right. Mm-hmm. If this was something that, you know, your words was you got excited about teaching the DISC assessment. Now, I think personality assessments are extremely, extremely valuable. I don't know that I get excited talking about them or necessarily teaching them. So I think that's really awesome that you have that self-awareness that this gets you going. So, you know, yeah, what's going on there that gets you so excited? Yeah, just go ahead. Just tell me that story there.
Yeah. I think it goes back to, I was a psychology major in college, and I had grown up just very fascinated by why people make the decisions they do. I've always enjoyed talking with people about the relationships they're in, the work that they do, and finding out the why behind it. I would call myself introverted, introspective at times, and I've always just kind of led this inner life that has almost compelled me to feel curious about why people are doing what they're doing. And not only answer questions for myself, but really help other people connect the dots. And I think certainly having been a psychology major in college and then having been introduced to DISC along the way in my HR role, it was a tool that I gravitated quickly toward that allowed me to answer some of those questions. And it's certainly not a one-size-fits-all tool, and oftentimes my workshops and conversations set DISC aside. But we start asking really fundamental questions about what is fulfilling for us, how we are motivated, how our fears may potentially limit us and hold us back from pursuing certain opportunities. And that's sure. where that back burner came in. Mm-hmm. You know, I've listened to your show often enough to hear you talk with people who are very direct and decisive and motivated, and they will take step one before they know what steps 2 through 10 are. That right. made me nervous as all get out. Ah. And I thought, well, yeah, this is something I really want to do, but it wasn't clear enough to me what those next steps were going to be to really run with it. And I'm somebody who likes to have a little bit more of a plan in place and have things be at least somewhat predictable. And I realize, you know, every day I realize how that keeps me from certain opportunities, but then how it also drives me toward others. And finally I thought, you know what? This whole back burner thing, it's just not working anymore. It's not going to allow me to focus on what could potentially be a very fulfilling career as an entrepreneur as I could have if I'm keeping it lower on the priority list. And so I changed things, and I'm so glad that I did, because I've learned so much about not only what meaningful work looks like for me, but how I can serve other people in answering that same question.
Gotcha. And I like how you mentioned, you know, a lot of the listeners are pretty decisive. I think I'd fall in that category, especially as like a high D on this profile. And also, you know, StrengthFinders 2.0, my top strength is activator. So I act and ask questions later, and, you know, like for better or worse. but I know there's listeners like you too, right? So we all know that first step, but they don't know steps 2 through 10. And so they're not ready to move. So what advice do you have for those type of leaders so that they don't necessarily wait too long, right? Because you realized, hey, this is on the back burner too long. It's time to make a move. So what is it in between that helps you make that decision to have progress, to move forward?
That's a great question. I think, as with so many other things, it really starts with knowing yourself. I don't think that there's too much you can do in life having the confidence of proper direction, whether personally or professionally, without first knowing what you bring to the table, how you're motivated, what your strengths are. And those are the questions that I'm trying to answer for people. Every style out there has its own strengths and limitations. Like you were saying, that person who's really direct and decisive and eager to take action and achieve and make progress, they are oftentimes, quote unquote, natural leaders in the sense that they are comfortable with risk. And I use natural leaders sort of lightly, because all personality styles can be leaders, but you often find that people in entrepreneurial roles or who are leading teams or businesses, they're more comfortable with risk. They're comfortable taking action. They're eager to stay ahead of the competition. Those things are certainly strengths, but then those people often admit at the same time, well, that eagerness to move forward means that I haven't necessarily gotten everybody on the bus. I've pulled away. There are some people who are behind. I don't have a consensus, maybe, or I'm not really taking into account the feelings or emotions of the people who are involved with the direction that we need to take. You know, leaders are tasking themselves with building a vision, aligning people with that vision, and executing on it. Sometimes, especially for that D or dominant style, they're so quick to get that to that executing stage that they, you know, that they don't bother to turn around to see that they haven't aligned people with that vision, and so they have to take a step back and focus on that. At the same time, on the other end of the spectrum, you know, for people who have that leadership style that's, instead of, you know, ready, aim, fire, it's more ready, aim, 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 and you never get to the point where
that makes me so mad.
You know, and I think that that is something that those of us who maybe tend toward that style are almost painfully aware of at times. You know, it's something that we realize can hold us back. So then the challenge becomes, how do we first become aware of that, recognize those environments and situations where that tendency is going to shine through, and know enough about ourselves to understand how we can adapt that behavior to be more effective, to say, all right, you know what? Maybe I haven't had time to do all the research I'd like to do. Maybe a consensus in this situation isn't going to be possible. You know what? It may not be comfortable for me. It may be not be my natural style necessarily, but I need to make a decision and move forward because it's going to be what's best for the team. And so that self-awareness allows you to play to your strengths, take advantage of those things that really do come naturally to you in those environments where you thrive and shine, but then also, you know, allow you to kind of dial down your ego a little bit and realize that we all have room to grow and develop, and that you are going to be better off if you recognize those potential limitations and do something to compensate. And whether that's learn how to adapt, grow yourself, or in terms of leadership, surround yourself by as diverse a team as possible. And so a lot of my conversations end up very quickly moving toward that word. What does diversity look like? How is it defined? And how are we surrounding ourselves by people who bring all sorts of strengths and limitations to the table?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I you know, in that illustration too of the ready, aim, aim. And I could substitute with aim is normally for me like talk and then let's read some more and you know, research. I just want to make a decision and let's go. Yeah. So could you talk to me, but also talk to the listeners? Like, I love that idea of building diverse teams. I know I've gone to seminars, and it's not going to serve me well to hire a bunch of people like me, right? I need to surround myself with others that complement my skill sets, build up my weaknesses, and have different strengths than what I have. So can you paint a picture for, I guess, how you use the DISC assessment, or maybe how you've run staff development with schools in the past, so that people can understand, you know, they might be getting excited about this right now listening, and they're going to call you up right after they are done listening to the podcast. So how do you use these tools to help schools be better?
I feel like I should take you on the road with me, Daniel. You're saying all the right things.
Well, I don't know. Are you hiring? I mean, we can work something out.
That word diversity is packed, you know, and I think for good reason. Some people are afraid of it. Some people are still trying to figure out what it means, how to define it. I think companies are a little too quick at times to define diversity in terms of things that are easily quantified, right? Because you have to report numbers to somebody. You look to define it in ways that you can quantify, and that isn't always easily done, you know, and I come along and say, yes, you know, ethnic diversity is extremely important. It's a huge piece of the puzzle, but it's not the only piece of the puzzle, you know. When you're sitting there quantifying ethnic and potentially gender diversity, well, how else can we define it? You know, communication style is one, the strengths that people, the backgrounds that people, the cultures that people bring to the table, and culture widely defined. So when I'm leading a workshop, whether or not it's with the staff of a school, and I've certainly done a few of those, we very quickly talk about, well, how can we begin to define diversity maybe in ways that aren't as easily quantified? And, you know, personality assessments can help us do that. But honestly, just asking questions of people, and whether it's during the interview process or certainly when they're already employees of yours or members of your team, you know, to reinforce, I think, the respect that you have for them. How do you spend your time? What do you enjoy doing? You asked a question earlier about reigniting that fire. Sometimes people just lose touch with got them into meaningful work to begin with. And so sometimes by surrounding yourself then by people who see the world a little bit differently and don't see the world through your eyes, you may think a company or a team full of people just like you would be fantastic. I guarantee you it would be until someone comes to you, you know, potentially your supervisor, someone above you, and says, I need you to work on this project or accomplish this task or have this conversation in a way that takes you outside of your comfort zone, you know, and not in an immoral or an unethical way, but I need you to consider doing something in a different way than you normally would. And we have a couple of options when that happens. Number one, we can say, all right, you know, I'll adapt, I'll accept the challenge, and some of our best leaders do that. Some people are in a position to delegate, and delegating is so much easier to do when you have intentionally surrounded yourself by people who look at the world just a little bit differently. And I think that intentional is such an important word to use, because oftentimes we hire, promote, all of those things accidentally. You know, we have a position to fill, we have somebody walk through the door, we need this position filled as quickly as possible, and it could easily be a teacher on your team. And we fill that position with the first person who walks through the door rather than being intentional about, now, wait a minute, let's get a sense of who we already have in place. Do we have any holes that we can fill in terms of communication style. You know, if we have a bunch of people who are moving ahead at all costs, do we need somebody? Could we benefit by having somebody on the team who says, no, wait a minute, you know, it's important to move ahead, but let's think this through, you know, and that's where that diversity comes in. And I think too often companies don't, they're not intentional about building diverse teams in a way that could really benefit them.
Yeah, not at all. And I could say, you know, you said companies, I'm going to say schools, at least in my experience, you know, there is a very big temptation just to make sure we get warm bodies and we want, you know, the most qualified bodies in front of our children. But to even take it to that next level of, you know, we've got four people on the English team and we need a fifth. And these four are actually very similar. Well, first of all, as a leader, do I even know how these people work and operate and what their strengths and weaknesses are, you know? And then can I find somebody that complements that team? And that type of rigorous thinking, I think, often gets put by the wayside or those questions aren't even asked or maybe even taught in grad school. You know what I mean? That's a higher level type of thinking for school leaders. And so I want to challenge everybody right now to really understand who your people are and try to pick folks that are going to round out that whole culture to make the school a better place. Another thing I love that you said too is just to ask questions of your staff as well. And another challenge for the listeners is, you know, if somebody lost their fire, there might be something going on internally there and it's their you know, issue and they need to work it out so that they could be better at the school. But look in the mirror too, because again, do you know that person's strengths and have you put him or her so wildly outside of what they want to do that they just feel stuck as well? It might just be our fault as the leader, just putting them in the wrong position. And if we moved them across the hall, they would thrive.
You hear so many examples of that, and I'm glad you brought that up, you know, and we could talk about any number of things, but think about like maybe the bank teller, you know, who has been in a position for a number of years, and this person is a rock star. They interact with people, they're friendly, they're personable, they're good at what they do, of course, in terms of handling the money and the numbers, but the reason that they are fired up about their role is to interact with people, you know, and solve problems and help people and answer questions. So then we, as their supervisor, come along and say, oh, you're so fantastic at what you do, we're going to promote you into a supervisory role. And that supervisory role is going to take you away from your customer interaction, you know, or to put it in the perspective of education, you know, we're going to take you out of the classroom and we're going to put you into more of an administrative role where you're not working with the children, which is something that you've always loved doing. It's what's kept you in this role and at the school for as long as it has. But to reward you, quote unquote, we're going to give you more responsibility, and that responsibility is going to be in an area where you don't feel that you thrive, where you don't have the fire in the belly for coming into work every day and putting in the extra time and, you know, spending your off hours and your off weeks working on lesson plans and going above and beyond. That person who might be the exact person that you need on your team because of the strengths they bring to the table and the fire that they have for what they do is somebody that you have just demotivated when you're trying to reward them. And unfortunately, so many of us end up in supervisory roles or in positions of authority and leadership, and we're not given classes on how to lead. So we resort to, this is something I talk about often, we can't help but resort to things like the golden rule, which we grew up with saying, you know, of course, treat other people the way that you would want to be treated. And we know morally and ethically what that serves. If you wouldn't want to be lied to, you certainly wouldn't want to lie to anybody else. But if we're relying on a rule that says treat people the way that you want to be treated, what happens when you're in front of somebody who doesn't see the world the way that you do, right, who isn't motivated the way that you are, have your fears? Well, the golden rule, of course, still stands and still applies, but we have to consider a different way of interacting with those people. And someone along the way coined the platinum rule, which says treat other people the way that they would like to be treated.
I like that a lot.
When you're hiring people, certainly when you're developing people, you ask them questions. Okay, I'm someone who's detail-oriented. I'm someone who takes time to think things through. how do you prefer to interact with the world? How do you prefer that other people communicate with you so that you feel that you are bringing the most value to the table? If you get answers to those sorts of questions, those are gold and worth so much more than so many of these traditional, you know, performance review, performance conversations that I think people are having more regularly.
Absolutely. Let me just repeat that platinum rule, because I know our listeners' leadership bells collectively have been rung like mine. But the platinum rule is treat people the way they want to be treated. And the biggest irony, I think, well, not the biggest, but an irony of our industry is that we ask educators to do certain things in the classroom. And for example, something very, very popular right now is this idea of personalized learning and really understanding who your students are and putting them on different pathways so they can explore things that interest them while teaching the skills and standards that the state or the nation, whatever, say is important. But we often forget that to do that with the adults. Like, we just don't do it at all. Or like differentiation, you know, or flipped learning. And, you know, we know that we shouldn't just lecture to students for 45 minutes, let alone 104 minutes on a block schedule. Yet with staff developments, we'll just talk at them for 3 hours. It's like, how do we not practice what we preach? So I love that platinum rule. Treat people the way they want to be treated. If you do that as a leader, you are going to be so good.
Well, imagine the principal who sits in his or her office and says, I don't need feedback. You know, I'm pretty good on my own. I have my, you know, I can chart my own course. I have my own direction. I don't really need somebody telling me what to do, nor do I need just an ongoing check-in, you know. But then the person that they've just hired, who they don't know particularly well, who happens to be filling a very important role on the team, is somebody who thrives by getting at least a little bit of feedback on occasion. You know, has the confidence to go throughout the day, but it certainly doesn't hurt. And they might actually want somebody on occasion checking in saying, how are things going? You know, are you getting all of the tools and resources and feedback you need from me as your supervisor? Are you being put in contact with other people on your team or within the school who can give you the perspective and the history that you're looking for? And in the absence of that, of going out on a limb, and not even going out on a limb, but really understanding what that person uniquely needs, the person kind of keeps his or her mouth shut, goes along, tries to please whomever he or she can please, and eventually, you know, resigns, because that just isn't, it's not that it's a bad school, it's not that that's a bad supervisor necessarily, but there, that gap is not being bridged.
Right. Let's pause here for a message from our sponsor. Today's show is sponsored by KickUp, a professional learning data analytics company that provides an easy-to-use platform, helping school leaders optimize their PD resources and efforts by soliciting and synthesizing teacher input on professional development needs, creating an intuitive and simple dashboard so leaders can take immediate and informed action to support teachers, measuring and reporting the impact of the PD efforts over time. Schools, districts, and charter networks leverage KickUp's platform and consultative support to synthesize data so that all stakeholders, administrators, coaches, and teachers can monitor progress, identify meaningful professional learning actions, and demonstrate and share impact. Learn more at kickup.co. Today's podcast is sponsored by the What Great Educators Do Differently conference on October 14th and 15th in beautiful Kansas City, Missouri. Let me give you two reasons to attend. There's visionary presenters at each What Great Educators Do Differently conference. You'll learn from a dozen or more presenters who are recognized nationally and internationally as among the foremost educational thinkers in the field. There's also connection opportunities. In addition to learning from presenters who are accomplished educational trailblazers, each What Great Educators Do Differently conference has time built into the schedule for a mini unconference, allowing intentional time for attendees from all over to network and discuss issues in which they're interested. You can learn more at WGEDD.com. Leading a school may be the most difficult job in the world, but what if I could guarantee that you could accomplish so much more in 1 year than you've been able to in any years past? The secret is to stop leading in isolation and to do so in community. The solution is to join one of my education masterminds. We meet weekly for an hour and discuss leadership and solve complex problems. Text Better Mastermind, that's all one word, to 33444. That's Better Mastermind to 33444 and start your journey to your best year ever. Now, back to the show. So, hey, I've been going way too easy on you throughout this whole interview, so we're going to pivot here to a much more challenging and introspective question, and I want you to be honest with the audience and let us know, what has been your worst leadership mistake and what did you learn from it?
Yeah, that's I think that's always a difficult question to ask, at least off the bat. I think for me, when I gave this a little bit more thought, there are a couple of that I can think of, but one primarily is, I think it's in general, how do I put this? Here's an example. I was leading a team once, and they were coming up with ideas of how we could boost morale in general in the office and kind of make it a fun place to work. And the team came to me and said, you know what? We think that there should be an employee recognition program. We think that the people who work here would thrive on being able to recognize one another for the great things that they're doing, you know, both little and small throughout the day. I, not being as evolved as a leader as I could have been, immediately shut it down. I didn't shut it down because it was a bad idea. I shut it down because I was not somebody who needed that sort of recognition or saw that it would be valuable for other people. Even though I had a group of people coming to me and saying that we think that this is something that would be valuable, I was letting my own values override what I was hearing from others. And so I shut that down. And I think pretty shortly thereafter realized, you know what? There are people in this office who are motivated in different ways and who do bring different strengths to the table and would not only thrive on being recognized in the ways that my team is suggesting, but by being given the opportunity to recognize other people. So what I had to do is I had to step out of my own way. And I think that that was an important lesson for me to realize that just because something might not appear to be of value to me based on what I need and want from other people, I need to understand that I'm surrounded by people who are motivated in different ways. And once I got out of my own way and realized that I need to treat people again the way that they wanted to be treated, that allowed me to lead so much more effectively than I would have had I stayed, continued to wear blinders.
Do you remember what shutting it down specifically looked like or words you used to communicate? No, there's a very specific reason I'm asking this. I'm going to follow it up once I hear your answer.
Yeah.
But I'm just very curious if you remember or if it was just something internal where you're like, oh, no, we're not going to do that.
Well, first the internal kicks in. But because I am somebody, and this is part of my personality style, it's a strength of mine where I can see where a scenario is going to go wrong sometimes before I see where it's going to go right. It's actually a strength I bring to the table because I can tell you, look, in case you haven't considered this, this is a potential obstacle we may face. It doesn't mean that I don't want the same outcome as you do, but I think I'm doing you a favor by identifying that obstacle. It first registers inside, and then without even blinking an eye, I think I say, that will not work, and here's why.
Okay. I normally just say no.
Well,
it's so much better to say that's not going to work and here's why or here's a solution. That's so much better. But the real reason I actually shared it is because I got an email from a friend, okay? I'm not going to say his or her name or describe in any way, shape, or form where they are a school leader. But the email talks about being in a meeting with a new superintendent. And literally, I'm reading from the email right now. This person remembers the superintendent saying, thanks for sharing your ideas. We're going to do it my way, to almost every comment from every principal, including myself. And there were complaints. And then, you know, the superintendent's curious, like, why when he brings new ideas to the table, people don't want to offer anything. And so, again, it just goes back to knowing your people, knowing how they're going to hear things, their communication styles. And I think it's to have tact and self-awareness and empathy when it's okay to disagree. But again, I'm not there at the meeting, but I could just see this going over very poorly. Thanks for sharing your ideas. But let me remind you, we're going to do it my way. I'm the boss, everybody.
It makes me cringe, and honestly, we could go off on nonverbal communication. You can only imagine his or her arms being crossed and, you know, a head being shaken. And
well, you should have seen how I was acting it out as I was like, I could have won some type of award.
Well, I learned pretty quickly, you know, no, that's not going to work. And even offering an answer, that was not the response that they needed, you know, and I quickly changed my tune thereafter and learned that you give it time, you know, you say, well, that's, you know, let's talk about that, you know, and talk it out and allow people to get their opinions on the table and just give it some time, you know, maybe it evolves into something that actually is doable or there's more to an idea than I had originally considered. But by shutting it down right off the bat, because I'm somebody whose personality style is to recognize why something or how something could go wrong, that didn't allow, number one, an opportunity for it to evolve into something that could work, or two, my team, which was the most important thing, my team to feel that they were being heard, respected, recognized that they had a voice in how to make the workplace, you know, boost morale for people in the workplace. And those are the sorts of things that leaders consider. You know, they consider what's the words that are coming out of their mouths. They're considering their nonverbal behavior. But at the end of the day, they are considering what their people need to hear, not only as a team, but as individuals, to feel that they are contributing something important to the workplace. And it becomes something that, or remains something that they're passionate about, or reignites in them the flame that they had brought to the position however many months and years ago.
So principals, other school leaders are pulled in a million different directions. It's not, you know, unlike many other industries with leadership roles. And, you know, you start Harmony Insights, and I'm sure there's a lot to, you know, do every single day. So how do you avoid distractions and stay focused? Are there certain types of boundaries or systems that you have set up to help yourself be successful?
Yeah, this is something that I've struggled with. I mean, I have professional aspirations, but I have an extracurricular life too. I actually sing with a couple of classical choirs in Chicago. You know, I like photography. I've taken guitar lessons and, you know, I kind of want a social life at the end of the day.
Right.
As well, my girlfriend wouldn't mind seeing me on occasion. So that, you know, that requires certainly a certain focus. A lot of people talk in terms of balance. You know, you talk in terms of work-life balance, and I've always been more of a fan of the word blend, recognizing that there are so many aspects to who we are, so many facets, and so many things that we're attempting to do in life. And talking about it in terms of balance means, okay, I have six different balls maybe that I'm trying to keep up in the air, and it does become a juggling act, as opposed to, well, over time, have I set my priorities in such a way that I know that I'm catering to, even if it's not, you know, all in one week or maybe today things are a little off center, but over time I'm familiar enough with what those priorities are that I know I'm being fed in all ways in the way, you know, that I need to be. And certainly being pulled in different directions, a couple of things come to mind, you know, Stephen Covey in 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, which I heard brought up on a previous podcast of yours as well. He talks about a number of things, you know, sharpening the saw. What are we doing so that we are catering to the different aspects of our lives so that we're giving our best at any given point? You know, I think drawing a distinction between in any given moment, what's important and what's urgent, you know, are the things that are taking up your time, are those really truly important? Are those going to move the needle? Are they going to develop your team? Are they going to, you know, earn your school potentially the recognition that it deserves based on the people you've surrounded yourself by? Or are they all of the little urgent things that appear to be important but are really just wasting time or belong further down on the priority list? I throw things in a calendar when stuff needs to be done. And ultimately, more recently, I've surrounded myself by people who can hold me accountable. It's one thing to tell myself or to put on a little post-it, okay, by the end of the week, I want to do these things, but it's quite another when you have somebody that you trust checking in on you and saying, remember at the beginning of the week or the month or the year when you said that these goals were priorities of yours? All right, you know, well, what have you done? You know, what have you accomplished? Show me what you've achieved along the lines of moving toward those goals that you had set out for yourself. And when you know that accountability is baked into the relationships that you've built, I think that helps you really stay on task in a way that might be easy not to do if it was just left up to you and your vices.
So Eric, what's a book that every principal should read right now and why?
I mentioned a little bit earlier that I would identify with being introverted myself. I am a big fan of Susan Cain's book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts. I think it's In a World That Can't Stop Talking is the full title. Susan Cain has a really popular TED Talk. She has a podcast, too. I don't know if you're familiar with her podcast.
I haven't, but you know, I've talked about the Willow Global Leadership Summit on the podcast and written about it on the blog. So I've seen her speak on this, and I think my main takeaway from one of her things in terms of working with introverts was, you know, you don't have to have every issue like hashed out verbally right away in a group every single meeting. And she just even suggested, I thought this was brilliant, like basically pose the question and then give people 15 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever, go right on your own, you know, quietly, wherever you feel comfortable, and come back after you've had time to process and then share ideas that way. And that's just one way you could honor introverts through meetings.
Yeah, her book goes into some of that. Her podcast, she just finished season one, and it really talks about raising introverted children and spends a lot of time talking about education in schools. And she makes a couple of great points. One, you know, is grading on participation, you know, and what that implies.
Yep.
I don't know necessarily how controversial that is, but she made a really good point that there are some kids that just almost fear participation. What are other ways that you can gauge whether or not they are engaged, you know, and learning and able to demonstrate that they're learning? She also makes the point along the way about how social media is potentially stunting emotional intelligence and keeping people from really developing that skill of observing other people's behaviors and relating to people, you know. And I think that that's something that more and more, especially as we're adopting technology into the classroom, that we're going to have to remain mindful of. You know, are we still encouraging children to interact face-to-face and interact with adults face-to-face and to articulate their opinions on things and demonstrate that they've learned something in ways that are, you know, maybe a little bit non-traditional at times. But I really do like her stuff.
So I know you mentioned, I normally ask guests what they do for fun. You mentioned that you sing classical music, you've played the guitar, you're into photography, and that sort of thing. So you also mentioned that you're really into music, or music's been important to you, and obviously in the name of your company, Harmony Insights. So tell us a little bit about what kind of music you like listening to. You know, what were you listening to today?
It's funny you mentioned that. So a lot of my music is, a lot of my world is classical music. And so today I was actually listening to Verdi's Requiem. So it's one of the big pieces I've been able to sing along the way. I just came off of a performance weekend a couple of weekends ago where I performed Mahler's Second Symphony in Evanston at Pigstager Concert Hall with Northwestern musicians. And then my first time on stage at Millennium Park, actually, a couple of Sundays ago.
Nice.
So during choir season, which is coming to an end now, it's a lot of classical music. But I've also been to, I think it's around 430 or 440 concerts altogether. And, you know, being the personality style I am, I have them nicely logged in an Excel spreadsheet. We can talk about that another time.
Yeah, but, right.
You know, it really runs the gamut. I think it's, again, just so important to have those things, even outside of work, that you know drive you. And I think that having those passions, for me, again, being music, really makes so much more of what I do fulfilling. Relationships, my work, just knowing that that's there and it's something that I can talk at length about and connect with others on, it really brightens up so many other aspects of my life.
I've never asked this question. We're about to play rock, paper, scissors, like not literally, but let's pretend we are. Uh-huh. And what do you typically throw first?
That's so funny. I've never been asked that, never really considered it, but I think I throw paper.
Okay.
It actually depends on who I'm with, and that's where we bring personality style back into it. If I know I'm playing with somebody who's a little bit more like direct and decisive.
Yeah.
People like that tend to think in terms of hierarchy and power. Yeah, I assume or anticipate they're going to throw a rock, and I want to cover that with paper.
And that's why I throw the scissors. One step ahead, Eric.
How about it?
Awesome. Well, hey, buddy, it's been a blast talking with you. You've made it to the last question, and then we'll wrap up the show.
Let's do it.
You're building a school from the ground up You're not limited by the budget. Your only limitation is your imagination. How would you create the school if you're given a blank slate and unlimited resources? What would be your top three priorities building the school?
I think that's a great question. I like looking at it, too, from a sort of a non-traditional perspective. I think I've been fortunate enough to go to some great schools and have some great teachers along the way. And I continue to learn about, especially through my girlfriend, what's being done in schools these days that might be a little bit different than anything I've experienced. So a few things that I would consider. I've learned some about the International Baccalaureate Program, where, you know, classes are really being integrated and you have math teachers who need to know what's going on in social studies, and social studies needs to know what's going on in science so that they can integrate learning. Sure. I think that's really been interesting to me. I would encourage exploration of students' diverse skills, abilities, and passions. And that can go in so many different directions. I listened to a podcast, one in particular, that's called the 48 Days Podcast, where the host, Dan Miller.
Yep.
Yeah. He talked, and I don't know how controversial this would be, but he talks about having driven around his hometown and he saw a sign outside of a high school that boasted 100% college placement. And he thought that was such a shame, you know, because there are some schools, and he understood kind of why they were putting that out there, but you know, there are some people who may not necessarily be fit for college potentially, you know, and who might be great in trades. And, you know, are we really asking kids to explore what drives them and where they think they have skill and ability and where their passions lie? And for some it may be college, you know, and things that are a little bit more academic and a little bit more traditional. And you never know what people's answers are going to be until you start asking and then catering to those in some way. And then lastly, the note that I have here when I looked at this question the first time was that just giving students real life experience as part of the curriculum and not just as an elective. And I say this because I think having gone to school myself at all levels, you know, study abroad certainly wasn't mandatory. It was an option. You know, different internships and apprenticeships were available. But I think now that I'm away from that a little bit, there's so much value in having real-world experiences and being able to demonstrate skill and to interact with people and build rapport and talk about soft skills like etiquette and relationship building and those sorts of things that can be done and worked into the curriculum. And maybe these things are being done in ways that I'm not familiar with, but I would love to see, for example, a class on emotional intelligence or an entire semester dedicated to helping children learn who they are and why they value what they value. And maybe a non-traditional approach to some of this stuff, but that's a lot of the soft skill that I'm working on with adults. And I would love for that to be integrated into schools as early as it can be.
So Eric, again, thank you so much for being a part of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. I nailed the name of my show that time. Do you have any parting words of advice, and what is the best way to get a hold of you?
Thanks for asking. I can't help but come back to the platinum rule, you know, and when it's so easy to treat other people the way that we would like to be treated, and we will at times, we know where that applies. Consider treating people the way that they would like to be treated, and it's so fundamental, but if you only take that away, your relationships will be stronger, your work will be more meaningful, and you'll experience life, I think, in a much different way. And in terms of how to get in contact with me, harmonyinsights.com is my website. Harmony Insights is the handle I use on Facebook and Twitter, and then Eric Kershaw. And, of course, you'll have the spelling of first and last names in your show notes. You can find me on LinkedIn, and I would love to talk to anybody in the education space about staff development, what they're doing in terms of some of these soft skills, not only with children but also with adults. I still have a lot to learn, and I would love to speak with anybody in your audience about those sorts of things.
Better Leaders, thank you for investing in yourself today by listening to this podcast. Remember that life is 10% of what happens to you and 90% of how you react to it. Go out there today and be a better leader. Today's podcast was brought to you by Daniel and Eric. Be better starting today by heading over to betterleadersbetterschools.com and type Eric in the search bar. The show notes page will pop up. You'll get the highlights of today's episode, links to all the resources, and the best way to connect. On most mobile phones, you can tap on the cover art and the show notes page will magically appear. Eric, thank you so much for sharing your leadership insights and helping the better leaders be better.
Thank you, Daniel. I had a fantastic time.
Better Leaders, thank you for joining us on the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Visit us at betterleadersbetterschools.com, a blog and podcast made specifically for you to help you meet your leadership potential. Have you gotten value from today's show? Help me reach even more listeners by leaving a 5-star rating and review. Click the podcast artwork and press the Show Some Love link to leave an honest rating and review. A long, long time ago in a galaxy far away, patrons would sponsor artists to create something the patron valued. Would you consider becoming a patron of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast? If you found this podcast valuable, if the show has pushed your thinking about leadership, and if you've benefited in any way, then I would be honored if you would become a sponsor. Sponsorship is easy. Head over to patreon.com/better or click the link in the show notes to become a patron for as little as $1 a month. If you pledge $10 a month, I'll send you one of my favorite leadership books every other month. That's patreon.com/better or click the link in the show notes. Do you have a question or need some leadership advice? I want to connect with you. I read every email, tweet, snap that's sent to me. Links are in the show notes to connect via email and social media. Better Leaders, Better Schools is a proud member of the Edu Podcast Network, podcast for educators, podcast by educators. You can listen to more great education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com.